You're listening to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Now here's your host, Tom Temin.
Cybersecurity and the battle to maintain it has entered a new phase. Autonomous machines are capable of writing malicious code, only to be discovered and neutralized by white hat machines, also operating on their own. A recent challenge sponsored by the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency pitted three company teams, each fielding autonomous bug-hunting machines. The winner was a Pittsburgh company called For All Secure. And joining me with more on how it all works, Tyler Nyswander, For All Secure's bidirectional engineer. Tyler, good to have you on.
Hi, thanks for having me.
First of all, what is a bidirectional engineer? It sounds like a train that goes up and down the tracks.
That's a bit of a tongue-in-cheek joke. So I do both reverse engineering, so trying to look at programs and take them and understand how they work, as well as normal forward engineering, I guess. So building systems like our autonomous reasoning system. So I kind of do both forward and reverse engineering.
Tell us what the contest, the DARPA challenge, was trying to accomplish. What were you doing in that room?
Sure. So the idea of this contest was basically try to see how well a computer system can work automatically with no human interaction, trying to take software, identify bugs, patch those bugs, and at the same time even exploit those bugs on other systems.
So it sounds almost like an application of machine learning in real time.
Yeah, so there's a bit of different concepts like machine learning, a lot of program analysis and things like that.
Is it? These are entirely software creations, right? It doesn't really matter what the hardware is?
Yeah, so the way this contest was created, every team that was participating got the same set of hardware. And so that way, you know, it wasn't like one team outspent another and just bought more hardware. It was everyone had the same platform to work on. And it was purely a contest of who could write the best software.
So I guess a better comparison would be it was almost like a contest of robots.
Yeah, exactly.
And autonomy means that there's no clicking intervention by the programmers or the engineers that develop these programs.
Yep, that's correct. So, I mean, during the competition, for example, our system had a blip and we wanted to try to reboot it or something. And that wasn't allowed because we're not allowed to do any interaction whatsoever. No humans could touch them, even reboot them or flip a switch. It was just kind of turned on and then stepped back and we had to watch.
And how long did a particular episode run before? Well, what was the end result of these two autonomous systems going at one another?
So there are actually seven total systems that were all competing kind of all together in this little in this competition. And it lasted about 10 hours. So just from the morning all the way until the evening, they were working on this. And at the end, our system was the first place system.
And so what did your system do specifically to achieve first place? Sounds like a cage match.
Yeah, so as I mentioned, there are a few different parts. So the first is we're given software and we have to automatically find vulnerabilities in it. So some of the software, it's modeled after real-world things like you know, email servers or web servers or things like that. And some of the vulnerabilities are modeled after kind of popular vulnerabilities, like the ones that were used to infect computers for Stuxnet or Heartbleed bug that a lot of people are familiar with. And so they kind of gave examples of these written in new software, and our system was able to automatically detect that the bug was there, create an exploit for it, so be able to demonstrate that this is a real software security issue on another system. And at the same time, it was able to patch its own system so that if you tried to, you know, get sensitive data off or try to take over the system, you couldn't.
We're speaking with Tyler Nyswander. He is a bidirectional engineer for the DARPA Challenge winner For All Secure. And so how does this all add up to practical application? What was DARPA trying to do here in the grand sense?
So there's a couple things. So the first is when you think of the world of cybersecurity right now, there's maybe thousands or tens of thousands of people that are really qualified to look at software. But the issue is we're not slowing down with how much software we write. So we're getting kind of this mountains of code that no one has time to look over. And so one of DARPA's thoughts was, wouldn't it be great if instead of having humans that had to look over every single piece of code, you could instead have machines that could handle some of this automatically for you. And so if we were able to get to that point where machines could kind of just offload all the work from humans, then we wouldn't have to worry so much about scaling up all our cybersecurity experts.
And how does bug hunting cross over into cybersecurity vulnerability hunting?
So if you want to find vulnerabilities, the first step is finding bugs. And some of these bugs may be exploitable in the sense that the bug can lead to a software security issue. And so if you're very good at bug hunting, then you can find lots of bugs and some fraction of them will be software security issues. So they kind of, they go hand in hand.
So can you, where in the chain of IT, if you will, do you see autonomous bug hunters living, or do they live in the pre-production, pre-compiling stage?
So there's a few different places. So yeah, so certainly one of the places is we'd hope that developers would use systems like this in order to check their software before they actually ship it to customers. And so that way, you know, you kind of nip it right in the bud before it becomes an issue. But the other place is potentially, you know, consumers who aren't able to, who don't have the skills to check their software for bugs, or IT shops who have, you know, lots of software that they can't possibly vet, could take some autonomous system like this and run it on all the software that they have. And it can, you know, fix some of the bugs, maybe not quite as well as a human, but it'll fix some of the bugs that they have and make them a little more secure, as well as warn them ahead of time about problems that they may have in the near term.
Could it someday live in firewalls and other network appliances, maybe looking for incoming software that might be anomalous?
Yeah, I mean, all of this is sort of, I mean, everything's kind of on the table, and that's all kind of the one goal that we're all working towards.
Tyler Nyswander is a bi-directional engineer for DARPA Challenge winner for All Secure. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
You can read more and share this interview with colleagues. Go to federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive and click Share with Friends. I'm Tom Temin.
Pentagon Solutions will return after these messages. Listening to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Now here's your host, Tom Temin.
Earlier, we reported that the Air Force is looking to add enlisted men and women to its aircraft crews. Well, the Air Force is also rethinking the way its forces are organized. Chief of Staff General David Goldfein directs three new task forces to assess the Air Force of the future. One task force focuses on the makeup of Air Force squadrons. We get more now from Federal News Radio Scott Massioni.
The Air Force is trying to prepare its force for the 21st century, and when the makeup of basic units hasn't changed in the last half century, that seems like a good place to start. Air Force Chief of Staff General David Goldfein says that's exactly what he wants to look into. Goldfein says the Air Force squadrons need to change to adapt to new threats. Violent extremism isn't the only threat the Air Force is dealing with. It has China, Russia, and cyber attacks to deal with as well. So Goldfein's creating a task force to look into the squadrons over the next 4 years to decide how they should be best structured. Here's Goldfein speaking at an Air Force Association event at National Harbor, Maryland. He's talking about squadrons and the unit manning documents, or UMDs, which instruct them.
So we're going to take a look at squadrons. And oh, by the way, if you take a look at the UMD and ask yourself the question, what does it look like today in terms of the total amount of time mission planning required for the weapon systems that we have today? And the average F-16 Block 50 is 15 hours. So if you see those trend lines and you ask yourself, well, what does a UMD look like now for a squadron versus Baron based on all the change? And the answer is, we actually have not changed it in over 50 years. So when we talk about revitalizing squadrons, we're actually not talking about taking manpower and money and throwing it at this issue. Quite frankly, we don't have it. This is to step back and ask ourselves the fundamental question, what does a 21st century squadron need to look like? I think it looks different. I think there may be a civilian-military mix to it. I think we may want to leverage the great gift of General Welsh and Secretary James and Chief Cody, which is that we have one Air Force with three components that are joined at the hip. And we ought to look at that and take a look at that at the squadron level and see if there's a different mix that we ought to look at. And we ought to redefine what a 21st century squadron looks like due to the missions of the 21st century.
What those squadrons will look like still remains to be seen. Goldfein says he's leaving the work to the task force. Here's Goldfein speaking with reporters after his speech about the future makeup of the squadrons.
Yeah, I don't know yet. And I'll tell you honestly, because if I start as the chief, giving everyone the how and the what, it will actually immediately limit the creativity that the Secretary and I are looking for. So what I've laid out for you is the why. And I need the team to come back and give us the details on what they think the how and the what should be. Because I truly believe what will happen is it will be different for each squadron, slightly different. There will be some missions that will be optimized for a guard reserve civilian mix, and there are others that won't be. And so if we try to attack this entire animal all at once, the chances are it may become too big. And so the way I've asked the team to look at it is more of a sequential. Let's find out those squadrons that we can look at first and create some success to build the momentum to create further success as we move this forward. But beyond that, in terms of details, I have some ideas in my head. I'm intentionally not sharing them so that the team can get creative for us.
Squadrons aren't the only thing the Air Force is looking into, though. Goldfein's standing up a total of three different task forces, all with different focus areas. One of the task forces will focus on joint leaders in the Air Force. According to Goldfein, the Air Force is a cohesive force for the military in terms of jointness. The Army and the Air Force need to be joined for conflicts with Russia, and the Air Force and the Navy need to be connected for the Pacific. Goldfein says the air component is essential to every campaign, and so strong leaders are a must. Airmen are currently staying too long in technical career fields because it takes them longer to get to the point of becoming instructors. That comes at a cost of joint training, though. The second task force will look into how to make joint training more ubiquitous in the Air Force. The task force will also look into how the Air Force presents forces to the combatant commanders. Here's Goldfein again.
I'm a bit concerned that over time, over the last 15 years, we have migrated into sending too many single airmen into combat for their first time. And while we will never be the service that says if you want an airman, you get an entire squadron, because that's not what the nation needs, we have to be more flexible than that. I think the pendulum perhaps has swung a little bit too much to sending individual airmen into combat. And what happens when you send an individual airman into combat is that single airman has got to go through all the process and procedures to get themselves into the theater, join a team there, build the lexicon of the joint community that they're joining. And we do that very well and very quickly. But I'm concerned that now I'm in combat, I have a significant experience, a combat experience, and then I come home and I'm back from my team into an individual airman. And I come home and the question I've asked is, who do I talk to? Who do I share my experiences with? Who can relate to what I've just gone through? So under the leadership of General Carlisle, we're gonna take a look at getting back into the business of deploying his teams. Now, I don't know what that team size looks like. It may be just three. But it'll have an established team lead, and that team lead will be responsible for making sure that team is organized, trained, equipped. It will deploy together, it will employ together, and perhaps the most important thing is it will redeploy and will reintegrate together.
The third task force will focus on intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. It will focus on fusing information from sensors to keep the military ahead of its adversaries. The task force sounds almost like a way to operationalize the Defense Department's third offset strategy. It's a way to bring together sensor, machine, and information architectures in new ways. But still, it might be a while before we hear anything from these task forces. Here's Goldfein again to explain.
Yeah, we're actually going to go slow to go fast, because these are each four-year efforts. They're each significant in scope and scale, and each of them are going to require a partnership across, you know, the joint force. It's across the major commands. It's across with our allies, with our undersea partners. So each of these is a pretty significant effort. So when I say we're going to go slow to go fast, I've actually resisted forward movement until we actually have a written plan that's written and presented to me and the staff and the leaders by the task force lead. So those task force leads have been put in place. They're now assembling their team to ensure that it's appropriately inclusive. That team will write the plan. That plan will be approved, and part of that plan will be a calendar-based model that says we have to hit these key milestones and measure these things along the way so we know if we're achieving our objectives. And so we're not ready to actually move out on that until we see the plan come back. And I'm not expecting on just the first task force alone, squadron revitalization, I don't expect to get moving until 1 January.
In Washington, Scott Massioni, federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
Share the story with colleagues. Go to federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive and click Share with Friends. I'm Tom Temin.
You've been listening to Pentagon Solutions. Download this show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Search Pentagon Solutions.
Check your thrift savings plan numbers every day at federalnewsradio.com. Find out how your funds closed and how they're doing for the year. It's all right there on our homepage, federalnewsradio.com.
Wi-Fi calling is a fairly recent feature. It's on the iPhone 6 and 6S, and Verizon finally supported it. AT&T has supported it for a while. It's been supported by Android phones for a little bit longer. Both cases, you need to activate Wi-Fi calling on your device. Kind of a privacy issue. Your phone is reporting back to the carrier if you're in a particular Wi-Fi network, and you may not want the carrier to know that you're on that Wi-Fi network.
Stratford University's Tech Talk Radio, Saturday mornings from 9 to 10 on 1500 AM.
The 2016 Greater Washington Government Contractor Awards finalists have been announced. The GovCon Awards honor the leadership, innovation, and commitment to excellence in D.C.'s GovCon community. Visit NovaChamber.org today to see the full list of companies and executives. The Northern Virginia Chamber and PSC thank BDO, Fifth Third Bank, PwC, Chase, Houlihan Lokey, United Bank, Colliers International, Cone Resnick, Hogan Lovells, and PNC Bank for their support of these awards.